Some stations on shortwave sound like they've been around since the dinosaur era, presenting stories the way they did in the 160s, 70s, and 80,000 years ago. Snap out of your Mesozoic mood and switch to Radio Netherlands, contemporary continental radio from the heart of Northwest Europe.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, Radio Netherlands Weekly Communications Review with Jonathan Marks. Today, a trip to the archives as we present A Colony Calls and Holland Answers Back, bridging a 7,500-mile gap.
Sometimes this program dips into other areas of shortwave communication than strict broadcasting topics. We're always being asked questions about some of the other noises you'll hear when you tune a shortwave radio between the international broadcast bands. This week, a new book has been published about a shortwave point-to-point station. It's here in Holland at a place called Kootwijk. These days, we tend to pick up a telephone and call round the corner or even round the world without really thinking how the signal gets there. But 65 years ago, it was very different, and I think a fascinating story. The full history of Kootwijk Radio really begins in 1916 in Indonesia, in Bandung, Java, to be precise. At that time, Indonesia was a Dutch colony, the East Indies. A brilliant engineer, Dr. Cornelius de Groot, was trying to persuade the Dutch government that direct communication between the East Indies and the Netherlands was possible. Cables from The Hague to Batavia were being sent via an English overland cable system, but they often got lost or took longer than a ship would take. Unlike neutral Holland, Britain was at war with Germany in 1916, and messages to and from distant parts of the Dutch Empire didn't take priority. De Groot first visited transmitter manufacturers in Europe and then in the United States. The German company of Telefunken had constructed a generator transmitter at a place called Nauen. It was designed for contact between Germany and South America. Its operation was ingenious. In modern electric power stations, steam-driven turbines are used to turn generators. The frequency of the alternating current produced is either 50 or 60 hertz. If you increase the number of poles on the generator's commutator, there's no reason why electricity with a frequency of, say, 5,000 hertz can't be produced. Telefunken constructed just such a high-frequency alternator, whose output was fed into a series of saturated transformers. They effectively doubled the frequency, so that transmission was possible, eventually, on a frequency of around 17 kilohertz. Now, there was no way you could superimpose speech messages onto this system. It was just a matter of putting a switch between the generator transmitter and the giant 2-kilometer-long antenna. This power to the aerial could be keyed on and off via a giant relay by the Morse code operator. The energy consumed by such a system was enormous. The output of the transmitter was some 400 kilowatts, but the consumption from the mains power supply was of the order of 1 million watts. All this energy to get one Morse code message across. De Groot had promised the Dutch government that direct contact with Indonesia was possible during the nighttime hours. He ordered two of the 400-kilowatt Telefunken transmitters, one being completed in 1917. But he also had sufficient funds to try his own experiments. He wasn't convinced that the Telefunken generator was powerful enough. So he purchased an American ARC transmitter and asked officials in Holland to tell him whether it was coming through. They replied that there were no receiving facilities in the Netherlands to pick up the signals. So de Groot decided to send a complete receiving station and install it near a place called Eemnes, a village just outside Amsterdam. In his book, Radio Life, Dutch author and later broadcaster Willem Vocht described what that receiving station in Holland was like.
Nobody in the village knew exactly what went on in the little wooden hut out on the marsh near Eemnes. It was built on stilts to prevent flooding from the Zuiderzee just visible on the horizon. A 20-meter vertical wooden pole had been erected next to one of the outside walls. Attached to it was an antenna wire that stretched some 2 kilometers out over the green fields, held up from the ground by smaller wooden supports. It was an eerie sight, especially on autumn afternoons, when the mist would play a game of hide-and-seek so that the radio house constantly appeared and disappeared from view. To step inside the radio house was to be transported back to the tropics. All the furniture had been sent by one of the government ships. It was, after all, Dr. De Groot that had to prove to the doubting officials at home that direct contact between Indonesia and the Netherlands was possible. In a corner was a wooden camp bed filled with fresh hay. As evening came, the radio operator would arrive on his bike from the nearby village. The first thing he did was to fill the paraffin lamp and then settle down for a bit of sleep. Around 11 p.m., the alarm clock would go. Now, with darkness over the path between Indonesia and Holland, this was the best time for reception from Malabar. Around 11 p.m., the atmospheric noise would die down. Out of the noise, you could hear the Malabar transmitter tuning up. Sometimes the signal would break off suddenly. Had there been a flashover in the transmitter, perhaps? Had one of the turbines broken down? No, there they were again, sending the Morse letter V. And then came the messages from the Dutch colony. Concentration was vital. There was no simple way the operator could send an instant message back to Indonesia to ask for a word to be repeated. Each telegram had a number. Sometimes, if there was interference, you could guess a missing letter. But more often than not, the government messages were coded. It was quite impossible to fill in the blanks. The communication system was obviously inefficient. So much power being generated in Indonesia to make a faint click in the headphones 12,000 kilometers away. Out there on the Eemnes marshes, the operator was entirely alone. Every so often, the rotating beam from Huizen Harbour Lighthouse a few kilometers away would illuminate the little wooden hut. Around 4 o'clock in the morning, the last messages would come through. Then the atmospheric noise would start to crescendo in the headset. Time to get some rest. Across the marsh, there would be the distant clanking of milk carts as they left the farms.
The Morse code operators in Indonesia had their own little messages for the man in the marshes back in Holland. They'd sign off by sending, "Don't forget to milk the cows," or "Stop for half an hour while breakfast was served in Malabar."
One dark night in December 1920, a northwesterly storm hit Holland. A red lantern shone from the town of Eemnes, warning of possible flooding. Telegrams from Malabar stopped early, and around 1 o'clock, the operator went to bed. He was awakened 5 hours later by a strange clotch, clotch from underneath the floorboards. Directing the paraffin lamp towards the window, the operator peered out. The marsh was under 4 feet of water. He was marooned until a boat came out later in the day to rescue him.
The Dutch government was convinced by de Groot's experiments and the German Telefunken Company that a transmitting and receiving station were needed in the Netherlands to complete the independent communication circle with Indonesia. They decided that the reception centre should be moved to a point in the south of the country, at Sandbeek, away from marshland that could flood. Back in 1919, a 400-kilowatt long-wave transmitter was thought to be sufficient, as signals on long-wave seemed to travel easier from west to east than vice versa. So 500,000 cubic metres of sand were shifted and levelled at a site in the middle of beautiful heathland not far from the centre of the Netherlands. The nearest village was Kootwijk. The transmitter building was unique. It not only survives today, it's still in use. In fact, it's now a Dutch national monument. Some people think it looks like an Egyptian sphinx from the outside. Others say it's more like a church. In any event, there's a tower in the front through which wires were thread to the giant long-wave aerials. And at the transmitter hall behind, there still houses the senders. Martin Neuenhausen is the current station manager. So was this building specially designed as a radio station?
Yes, specifically for this purpose, yes. It was just for a radio building. The transmitter is bought by Telefunken Berlin company by then. And a Netherlands architect has had the order to build the station.
But he didn't quite know how big the transmitter was going to be.
No, he didn't know. So they said from Berlin, well, you have to make something. It's about this and about that and about such one. But he didn't know exactly what kind of measurement he should handle for it.
So what? How did they fit when they finally bought the transmitter?
Yeah, the transmitter by then installed. It was a machine transmitter with a very big generator. But in the transmitting room, as you can see, it was a very, very small transmitter, actually.
Back to Indonesia, where after experiments with the American ARC transmitter, engineer Cornelis de Groot had now designed a giant 2 million watt long-wave ARC transmitter. In 1917, with war still raging in parts of Europe and supplies scarce, he and a huge team of locally recruited labour set about constructing the sender. They first decided that a military air balloon might be a good way to support the antenna. But then de Groot had learned of an ideal spot some 35 kilometres south of Bandung. It was the mountain of Malabar. There was a natural gorge in the side of it. There was plenty of space for a transmitter building, and the distance between the two peaks of the gorge was about 2 kilometres. Despite the severe heat and the tremendous effort to clear the jungle undergrowth, the construction teams pressed on. It was difficult cutting a path up to the 900-metre vertical side peaks of the mountain. Power was to come from nearby hydroelectric generating plants. Some photos survive of this giant transmitting complex. The building was made of wood. No nails could be used because there was a danger they might absorb the transmitting energy, heat up, and set the transmitter centre ablaze. Some of the other statistics are amazing. The weight of iron used in the magnetic circuit round the arc was some 184,000 kilos, and the bronze arc chamber weighed another 4,000 kilos. Working at a frequency of 19.2 kilohertz, the antenna wire was fed with 500 amps of current at a tension of some 2,600 volts. De Groot lived in an era where little was known about how signals propagated from A to B. He was convinced that the bigger the power, the better the reception. Mind you, even when they used the standard 1300 kilowatts, the harmonic radiation from the transmitter splattered all over the radio spectrum. In those days, though, there weren't enough users of radio to complain. There was an official opening day of the new ARC transmitter on May the 5th, 1923, though this was arranged without consulting de Groot. Government dignitaries were invited to a grand ceremony where a telegram of greetings was transmitted to Queen Wilhelmina back in the Netherlands. Drinks were served while they waited for the reply. It never came. The transmitter was being keyed, but a technical fault meant that it wasn't actually on the air. Luckily, de Groot wasn't to blame for the fiasco. Holland, the 400-kilowatt long-wave transmitter at Kootwijk also started service in 1923. But just 2 years later, the first shortwave telegraphy transmitter was installed. it was clear that the use of frequencies above 3 megahertz was a much more efficient way of bridging huge distances. The propagation experience gained at Kodvac was also useful to the Philips laboratory in Eindhoven that was busy with shortwave broadcasting experiments.
This is station VCJ at Hilversum, Holland. We continue our happy program, and I remind you once more of the fact we are very anxious to have your reception report. Well then, with Gerardo...
The sound there of PCJ, the first shortwave broadcasting station in this part of Europe. Gradually, more shortwave transmitters were added to Kodvac, each carrying Morse code messages and later phone conversations, not only between Holland and the Dutch East Indies, but New York, London, Berlin, and other major cities around the world. A little later, a song was written, which described how a mother in Holland tried to keep in contact with her son in the Dutch East Indies via the shortwave telephone link. Hallo Bandung became a hit.
Hallo? Bandung? Ja, moeder, hier ben ik. Dag, lieve jongen, zegt ze met een snik. Hallo, hallo. Hoe gaat het, ouwe vrouw? En dan zegt ze alleen, ik verlang zo erg naar jou.
A long-wave broadcast transmitter on 160 kHz was installed at Kodvac in 1936. It wasn't in use for long, though, before on May 11th, 1940, other owners took over.
But in the 40s, the German took over the station, and then, actually, it's the first time that you see the station get some maritime use. It's not so very nice, but the Germans used the station for the ship-to-shore traffic with the U-boats in the North Atlantic and the North Sea.
Because, obviously, it was long wave.
It was long wave, so it's very useful for U-boat communication.
Unlike shortwave, those long-wave signals would penetrate underwater. Ironically, since the Germans had originally built the Kodvac station, when they invaded Holland, they brought the plans of the transmission centre with them. An attempt to remove and bury vital transmitter components on the morning of the invasion proved fruitless. In the afternoon, a German commandant made an inventory of what was missing and forced the staff to reveal where they'd been hidden. But with Kodvac being used to communicate with German submarines and broadcasting Nazi propaganda, why didn't the Allies just bomb the entire station out of existence?
The station is lying in a very flat piece of terrain, so there was no problem with bombing it. But there was no interest to bomb it because the English had by then in 41, I thought, had captured a U-boat in the Tyne and say, put out of that U-boat the Enigma code machine. So the English were the rest of the war able to listen to the broadcastings of the German Kriegsmarine.
In the last days of the war, some Allied shells hit the building, evidence of which can still be seen on one of the gangways in the transmitter hall. But the retreating German army then decided to blow up the station before they left. Holes were shot into transformers and the antenna masts at Kodvac was sabotaged.
Yes, it's one of the 200 meter masts. Its weight was about 80 tons. They have put it over the building, one point of the building, but it actually has no made any damage to the building itself.
So the idea, of course, was to try and destroy it, everything?
Yes, evidently, yes.
So what happened then after you got it back?
Well, it was a mess, of course. There was nothing in its place. The machine transmitter was completely destroyed. Also, the transmitters for the long-wave transmissions who were installed in this building were completely destroyed. The short-wave transmitters who were installed in other buildings, south of here a little bit, I show you that, they were stolen and taken with them to Germany.
So what did you do then? You must have changed the course, because I noticed that after this particular period, there's no, for example, long-wave broadcasting from Kodvac anymore.
No, that's right. After the war, there's nothing built up as long-wave transmitters, but they've built it up with short-wave transmitters.
In its heyday, in the 1950s and 60s, Kodvac had up to 50 shortwave transmitters in operation, all carrying point-to-point communications between Holland and the rest of the world. At that time, shortwave links were cheaper than the transatlantic cable, and satellites were only in their infancy. But the power used was nothing like what's currently the norm for shortwave broadcasting.
No. The biggest transmitters we've used in here for the after-war period for shortwave traffic, the biggest of them was about 30 kilowatts. At the moment, we use 30 kilowatt transmitters as well, but only at the highest level of 10 kilowatts.
I see, and you're also working on single sideband too.
And we also work on single sideband, but that's not new because for the war we've also worked on single sideband. In 1933, the first experiments were there with single sideband, and in 1936, we have four-channel single sideband in use by this station.
So it's certainly not new.
No, certainly not.
This is Amsterdam calling on a transmitter of the Netherlands PTT. This is Amsterdam calling on a transmitter of the Netherlands PTT. This is Amsterdam.
Between December 1965 and July of 78, Radio Netherlands relied on the point-to-point station at Kootwijk to feed the relay stations in Bonaire, Netherlands Antilles, and on the island of Madagascar. Feature programmes could be taped 3 weeks in advance, but news and current affairs went by single sideband. As satellites have taken over the international telephone links that used to go by shortwave, so Kootwijk has changed its function.
Hello all ships, hello all ships, hello all ships. This is Scheveningen Radio, Scheveningen Radio, Scheveningen Radio with the traffic list. Good afternoon. We have traffic on hand for Delta Victor Lima November, Delta Victor Lima November, Delta Zulu Sierra Yankee.
The Dutch ship-to-shore station, Scheveningen Radio, has landline links to the shortwave transmitters at Kootwijk.
We make the connections with the ships all over the world. There's also a station called Scheveningen. That's also a transmitting station, but it handles the ships in about 500 till 1,000 kilometers around.
So over 1,000, that's your job?
Over 1,000, that's our job, yes.
Ship to shore, do you read me anymore? This line is bad and fading. Ship to shore, answer my call. Send me a signal, a beacon to bring me home.
Shortwave remains a cheap method for maritime communications. But will there come a time when it'll be completely replaced by satellites?
No. That's what some people think, but at the moment, the only traffic we made from here is the ship-to-shore traffic. And we use at this single moment 30 transmitters daily to make the traffic possible. Also, we must say that there is, of course, a little bit reducing in the traffic. The Morse traffic is tumbling down. Of course, last year about 20%, I heard. So this is going down, but the number of transmitters is as it was 30 at the moment, and all in use.
In fact, the trend is towards more use of telex over radio, a more reliable method of getting written messages across the ether than conventional Morse code. No matter what the future of shortwave point-to-point stations, I hope they preserve the Kootwijk radio station building as a monument to the past, a reminder of the days when one message to the Dutch East Indies was pounded out with a power approaching 500,000 watts. Nostalgia has obviously started to affect the dedicated team of PTT engineers who work at Kootwijk. In the tower part of the building, a small museum is taking shape.
Yes, that's right.
What have you got? Some of the old transmitter tubes?
Some old transmitter tubes, but also some old transmitters, some old receivers.
But is it possible to keep all your transmitters going? After all, some of them are indeed quite old.
No, by now we have to put out one of the transmitters because it wasn't any longer possible to have it in use because the tubes we use in it were not longer available from the factory. But this transmitter has made over 40 years of traffic, 24 hours a day, so we didn't complain about it.
Don't you feel a little bit isolated? I mean, if you're working in the broadcasting industry, I mean, okay, you're close to the studios or you can hear things going on in the background. Whereas here, you've got, obviously, point-to-point communications, you've got Morse going out, and you're also in the middle of nowhere. Isn't it a bit isolated?
That's right. It is in the middle of nowhere. You say that right. But isolated, no. We are happy with it. I'm just one of the guys who love the old transmitters with axes and motors and big switches and glowing bulbs in it. And I'm not so very computer-minded man as you should be expected on in here.
Mind you, sitting up in that big hall at night, yeah, watching those transmitters glowing. And in fact, there's a neon bulb above each of the transmitters that's going in sync with the modulation. It must be a sort of strange feeling, I would have thought.
Yes, it's not only that. Glowing transmitting tubes, signaling lamps, and especially when it's absolutely dark in the transmitting room, you can stay there for hours, I think. It's very mystic, and that are the kind of things I miss in the modern computerized transmitters. There's nothing to see on it. It's all closed. You can't have a look in it. There's no life in it, and you can say here, when you hear in the transmitting room, it lives completely.
It's magic.
It's magic. Yes, it's pure magic.
That was Martin Neudenhausen, station manager at the Kootwijk shortwave station. My thanks to him and to Louis Mulste and Kay Wienden for their assistance with background research.
Media Network, serving up a communications menu complete with the source.
We're off now to London and a BBC request for £1 million of public funds to start a world television news service has been rejected by the British government. Foreign Affairs Under-Secretary Tim Egger told the House of Commons yesterday afternoon that the provision of such public funds could not be justified. And digital audio tape is back in the news. If you remember, music publishers have been alarmed by the development of a small cassette tape that can record in perfect quality, equivalent in fact to the compact disc. Consumer machines have been developed, indeed some have already been made, and have had to be stored away in warehouses while the problem of copyright is solved. In the United States, the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado, was asked to examine a spoiler system developed by the record company CBS. Since the idea was presented, the record division of CBS has been bought by one of the largest supporters of DAT, the Sony Corporation of Japan. On the line now from Boston, USA, is Lou Josephs, because I understand, Lou, that yesterday afternoon some important results were released.
Jonathan, the National Bureau of Standards 5-month test at the request of the United States Congress on that copy code chip found the chip sometimes permitted the recording of music that was specially notched at the factory to block taping. Sometimes the chip stopped the recording of the music altogether that it should have let go through. The study also found, and this probably comes as no surprise, that listeners could hear a discernible difference in the music when it had the copy prevention code. Now, what does this all mean for the consumer? Well, it severely undermines the credibility of the recording industry, who has so far led an unsuccessful fight to get Congress to require that anti-copying code on DATs, and it's surprised and disappointed by the study. So what does that mean on seeing a home DAT machine on the American market? It appears there's no reason why manufacturers shouldn't be selling them, and that's what Gary Shapiro of the Home Recording Rights Coalition said. But the recording industry, Jonathan, says they'll sue any manufacturer that tries to sell a machine in the United States before that copying issue is resolved, either through legislative process or through negotiations in the industry.
But, Lou, aren't DAT recorders already on the market in North America?
There are professional DAT recorders on the market in the United States available from the Sony Corporation at a quite substantial fee. You also can, through gray market means, buy the Sony recorder that's on sale in Europe. Additionally, there is a Kenwood playback-only AM-FM DAT player that is available for your car that is on sale in this country.
But that can't record.
It cannot record.
Well, thanks, Lou. And now to the news that the pop music ship Radio Caroline has commenced shortwave transmissions. In fact, they've been heard as far away as Wisconsin, USA on 6210 kilohertz. They were active again yesterday afternoon between 15 and 18 hours UTC. The power, we're told, is just 5 kilowatts. In 7 days, we'll be around with a feature on the upcoming solar eclipse and media news from Arthur Cushion. Till then, have a nice weekend. And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.